This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Ice caps are melting, ocean levels are rising, and coral reefs are dying. The way things are going, some scientists say the world could be unfit for human habitation by the end of the century. All eyes are on Paris right now as world leaders negotiate an agreement to slow the effects of climate change. A deal is expected by tomorrow, but there are still big issues to resolve between the industrialized and developing nations. Secretary of State John Kerry called for further action and compromises when he spoke at the conference yesterday.
If the scientists are right and the climate skeptics are wrong, we face catastrophe. It's that simple. That is the choice.
Any plan to lower carbon emissions will likely include more renewable energy like solar, a topic of debate here in North Carolina. Justin Catanoso is the director of journalism at Wake Forest University. He's in France to cover the UN conference, and we talk to him right now. Welcome, Justin.
Hello, Frank.
So, Secretary of State Kerry says it is that simple, and yet, I would think, at a gathering of more than 190 world leaders, nothing is simple. Where do things stand right now?
Well, let me give you a quick update, because we are theoretically in the last 24 hours of negotiating. The delegates stayed until 5 a.m. this morning. They whittled the text down from 48 pages to 29. There were earlier in the week some 900 differences that they needed to figure out. They're down to under 100. This idea of loss and damage, poor countries being compensated for environmental damage from climate change, is in the text as we speak. And there's some optimism that they might get an agreement by 6 p.m. tomorrow, but nobody believes that's going to happen. Everybody thinks it's going to go into overtime.
We should talk about some of the things that are at stake here. I mean, on the one hand, there's limiting the effects of global warming. You can do that by measuring. I mean, the planet's been heating up. Human activity is responsible for a good part of that. There's no doubt. So now you say, well, let's limit that by, oh, say, 2 degrees or 1 degree. Tell us where we are on where to cap global warming.
Okay, so we came into this conference with every nation in the world, 186. There were 10 that didn't, Syria, you know, the places that are sort of at war. They all put in voluntary emission reduction standards that they said that they would abide by. And they put in sort of their regular hope and then their most ambitious hope. Their most ambitious hope leaves us only halfway to the target that was original, which is keeping the Earth from warming from pre-industrial times to 2100 under 2 degrees centigrade. So that's like 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. That's where we started. But everybody realizes right now that if we go to 2 degrees by the end of the century, that's too hot, and we likely will have a planet that is uninhabitable.
So you're saying the cap they agreed on is what is one that's frankly pretty questionable in terms of its outcomes.
It's too high. Yeah. It's just too high. Everybody really is starting to see that. I heard press conference after press conference this week with NGOs just coming out and saying 1.5 to stay alive. And so that has worked its way into the text, the idea that we need to keep that we've already warmed 1 degree centigrade. So we only have a half a degree to go in the next 75 years if we're going to sustain life on Earth, or if it's going to be manageable in any kind of way. It seems like there's this desire to move away from the two, but that's going to be a real fight, because that means much more drastic reduction in the burning of fossil fuels.
Now, we have this tension between the developed world and the developing world. Much of the global warming and carbon emissions that have been thrown into the air and caused the problem so far have been put there by industrialized nations.
Absolutely.
Who've been at it for, you know, 150, 200 years.
Yep.
And the developing nations are saying, hey, wait a minute, you caused this mess and now you're changing the rules of the game. Let us catch up, right?
Frank, listen to this. You know, China was not in the ball game in carbon emissions until about 10 years ago. It is now the leading emitter by a wide margin over the United States of carbon emissions. But in that period of time, they've lifted over 400 million Chinese people out of poverty. It's unprecedented. It's bigger than the population of the United States. And they've done this by burning coal primarily and building big cities with factories. India wants to do the same thing. And they're saying we deserve our opportunity to lift people out of poverty. And we need an energy source. And the energy source we have is coal. And that's where the rub is right now. And so how are we going to move away from this idea that of all the carbon that's in the ground, all the oil, all the gas, all the coal, we can only take 20% out. That's it. If we take more than 20% out, we might hit this tipping point that the worst case scenario climate folks say will hit.
So how does that conversation even continue? Do you talk about a two-tiered system, a multi-tiered system, or just compromise on the outcomes?
Here's what we're hearing, and again, there are so many press conferences here every day, Frank. It's just it's mind-boggling. There's this idea that what comes out of Paris is not the end. Okay, you know, Paris is sort of the unprecedented first time ever. You know, we've had 21 of these COPs. You can figure that 20 of them have been a failure because we've never had an accord, right? We've never had an accord that we've all agreed on. But this time, we really are going to get an agreement where 186 nations agree to reduce their carbon emissions to some degree and to stop deforestation to some degree. Then we've got to do better. So now there's talk about when do we come back and put the pressure on developed nations to do more. Is it next year? Is it the year after? Is it 2018? Those are all part of this. It's like Paris is a pivot point. Paris is a point where we can start to build the leverage, get everybody on board, and then really start to turn the screws.
There are costs and benefits in changing. Obviously, if you talk about renewables and any new technology to provide power, anybody in that industry makes billions and billions. Yeah. So that's a good thing. On the downside, if you're already in these old, mature technologies and extractions, well, you don't want to lose. There are costs. What's the discussion around who pays for the change?
You know, there's discussions that are going on at every level. I mean, they're going on in North Carolina right now. So the state legislature, a month or so ago, decides to eliminate subsidies for solar energy expansion, even though there's like a 10-to-1 benefit for every dollar they put out. There are 10 more dollars coming in, and plus a bunch of jobs as well. There is this thinking that there are tens of millions of jobs just waiting in the new energy economy if we move in that direction, if entire countries go to renewable energy, which a lot of European countries are sort of on the verge of, including Norway and Germany, the United Kingdom. They're all talking about how do we get off fossil fuels completely. And when they do that, it's what John Kerry says, we unleash an incredible new economy of new innovations and new jobs you're not even going to believe. And those folks in the mature industries of coal and gas and oil, they're going to have other opportunities. They're going to have other jobs, just like we replaced the textile jobs in Greensboro.
We're talking about climate change talks in Paris today on The State of Things. Justin Catanoso is my guest. And what about the transition costs? Some interesting proposals. Saudi Arabians, for instance, have offered an interesting proposal to help to make a contribution to the end of global warming. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, everyone is trying to figure out how can they get the best deal possible for themselves. So Saudi Arabia is one of the largest pumpers, producers of oil. Now, they don't burn a lot of oil. They send it somewhere else and it could burn somewhere else. We used to burn a lot of their oil. What they're saying is, if you pay us for every drop of oil that we leave in the ground at market prices, we'll stop pumping. It's a little bit of a, let's call it a hostage-taking kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you want to call it what it is, it's a hostage-taking kind of thing.
But it does.
Saudi Arabia has to stop pumping oil,
right.
Period.
And there are these transition costs. So that's an issue. I mean, that may be farther than anybody's prepared to go, but the idea of having to pay the cost of taking industries out of transition, the workers who might lose their job, et cetera, there are these kind of costs. And then there's the private industry as well and how things would affect businesses that are already dependent on fossil fuels. You spoke with a representative from VF Corporation in Greensboro, one of the biggest companies in this state. What did you learn about the private sector and its role in fighting climate change?
You know, if you're not in the fossil fuel industry, everybody's ready to do this. There are 150 companies that have signed on to this pledge from the White House to put out to reduce their carbon footprint. And VF Corporation, which is one of the world's largest apparel makers, has signed on to that. They have pledged to, in their power usage, by 2025, be completely on renewables. They are in the process of building solar panels, raised solar panels on their parking lot in their headquarters on North Elm Street in Greensboro, that by the end of next year will provide 30% of the power to their headquarters building. And they're going to produce that themselves, and they're going to buy those solar panels from a company in North Carolina, most likely. So this is where big companies are going. It's the fossil fuel companies that are sort of holding things back, and to a large degree, the energy companies as well, because this is what they do. They burn fossil fuels. They don't know how to make wind turbines. They don't know how to make solar panels. They're very reluctant to move in that direction when they own all this oil and coal that's still in the ground.
Of course, all of us are already feeling the pinch of climate change, but in poorer countries, the costs are even higher and felt more deeply. And there's cost to talk about sort of paying the cost of the damage already done. Tell us about that.
So we've got island nations, and they are the most vulnerable. And these are the folks that are getting a lot of attention. You've got the Maldives. You've got Seychelles. You've got the Marshall Islands. Quite frankly, you got the Outer Banks. I mean, these are places that are going to go underwater in the next 25 to 50 years if we can't dramatically reduce global warming. And so what they're saying is we need to be compensated. We need money that can either help us raise all our buildings or build seawalls. And that is something that is playing out in these negotiations right now. How much money is it going to cost? Who's going to pay for it? Where is the money going to come from?
All right. So what is the likelihood that we will get something soon out of this conference?
Pretty likely. Look, Paris is not going to fail. Now, whether we get a great agreement that everybody's excited about, that's unlikely. But there is almost no chance that we are going to come out of Paris with no agreement. The last time a COP completely failed was Copenhagen, and that was in 2009. It put such a shock into the system that everybody just pulled back and said, we need a different way of doing this. We need to stop dictating to all these countries. The UN said this. We need to stop dictating terms. We need folks to come in and say, this is what we're willing to do. That's what we're doing this year. That's why we're going to get an agreement, but it's going to be far from perfect.
All right, Justin, thanks so much for talking with us.
Glad to do it.
Justin Catanoso is Director of Journalism at Wake Forest University. He's in Paris following the climate change talks. Just ahead, we examine the century-old history of Mexican immigration to North Carolina and the South. And you'll hear about it on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us.